Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Riley, and Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. We're now calling case A20-1526, Bella Vista Condo Association versus Western National Mutual Insurance Co.
Good morning. First of all, thank you for participating in these remote arguments. We are not in person, but the same rules apply as if we were in person. I do want to say a couple of things. First off, we understand that from time to time there might be interruptions, doorbells or pets or children, but we will try and keep them to a minimum, ask that you do the same. If for some reason we do have a technical difficulty, if someone freezes or drops off, we'll do our best to stop the clock and make sure you each have the full time allotted to make your arguments. Please remember that we're recording these proceedings, at least the audio of the proceedings. So before you begin, if you would state your name and the party that you represent, this is also a good reason why you want to mute your microphones when you're not presenting an argument. And finally, we require that all parties and participants refrain from making their own recordings. And if we have no questions, then Ms. Hunter, you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the appellants Bella Vista Condominium Association individually and as assignee of Watertight Specialties, Inc., Gorey & Associates, LLC, and Varian Gorey. This is an action seeking a declaration of insurance coverage owed by Western National to its insured Watertight for the $2.9 million judgment entered against Watertight on September 24th, 2018. Unfortunately, the trial court did not address the insurance coverage issues, but instead dismissed the lawsuit premised solely on its misperception that the premise of this lawsuit was on a $2.9 million judgment entered by agreement of Watertight in Bella Vista, which it was not, and that because the agreement failed to allocate between covered and uncovered damages, it ruled dismissal of this action is required under Minnesota law, thereby granting summary judgment dismissal to Western National. But the dismissal based on the no allocation rationale has been rejected by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Kings Cove. Accordingly, the sole grounds for the grant of summary judgment to Western National must be reversed. Appellants recognize that Western National...
Ms. Hunt, I'm sorry, before you move on, I just wanted to follow up with that, just so maybe I better understand the argument of the relevance or lack of relevance from your client's standpoint of the assignments that have the phrase Miller Shugart in it. Am I understanding correctly your client's position that, but for the default, let's presume the default judgment had not been obtained. What I'm trying to understand is then what would the error have been based on the particular assignments entitled Miller Shugart in this particular case? In other words, I'm assuming at a minimum the court could not find it per se unreasonable, but would there still be error? In other words, because there would have to be a fact finding as to the allocation, and maybe that goes to the coverage issue. So I don't know if my question is quite clear, but I'm trying to get a handle on maybe in part my sub question is what the whole point of the assignments were, given your primary position that you have the default judgment, which gives the direct action against the insurer.
Right. The whole point of the assignment was simply at the point in the time the declaratory judgment action was pending, there was no reason not to have cooperation from Watertight. I mean, Watertight had been not denied all coverage by Western National. There's a declaratory judgment action pending. So it just makes sense that Watertight assign its rights to Bella Vista, but in turn, Watertight gets that it would have no personal exposure. That's all it did. But there was never, the agreement talks about Miller-Shugart, but it's not a Miller-Shugart, because in a Miller-Shugart agreement, as the court is well aware, what happens is there is a dispute between the parties, they decide to agree among themselves, and then they stipulate, and then they ask the court to enter judgment pursuant to that stipulation, So then the claimant can go pursue the insurance company. Here we already have, we have a default judgment, we have an adjudication, and nothing changed in the declaratory judgment action. If you look at the complaint and the amended complaint, the allegations are the same. So, you know, our position has always been, Kings Cove aside, if the Supreme Court had not ruled as it did in Kings Cove, this court's decision in Kings Cove would not have supported what the trial court did.
Well, what was the point of mentioning Miller-Shugart in both the assignment of claim and the supplemental assignment of claim if that's not what the parties want us to look at?
The reason for it is because of the fact that in a Miller-Shugart, what you have is a circumstance where you have the insured being released a personal exposure and assigning it. So that's the only reason that it could possibly exist that Miller-Shugart is even cited in there. But when you look at the terms of the agreement as a whole, it's not a Miller-Shugart agreement. And this court has, you know, dealt with other so-called Miller-Shugarts where you've ruled it's not an authentic Miller-Shugart. You've done the same in Perringer releases, where, I mean, the party calls it a Perringer, but it's not really a Perringer. So you always look at the terms of the agreement itself. Appellant recognizes that Western National has asserted on appeal their alternative grounds to support the summary judgment grant to it. None of these were addressed by the trial court, and appellants assert this court should not affirm on these alternative grounds. Turning first to the notice issue, Western National asserts, citing to the provision in its policy entitled Duties in the Event of Occurrence, Offense, Claim, or Suit, that it is entitled to summary judgment. Now, there are a number of reasons why Western National argument fails. First, when Western National denied coverage, which was in its April 1, 2019 denial letter, it did not assert untimely notice as a reason. An insurer that denies a claim for reasons unrelated to late notice waives objection of untimely notice absent explicit assertion of a notice defense at the same time. So hereby Western National's failure in the April 1 letter to explicitly cite untimely notice as one of its reasons, it has waived that defense.
Ms. Hunt, if you could pause for a second and give us the authority that you're relying on. I note that in the brief there's mention of a treatise and an Eighth Circuit case that has a holding that's consistent with the proposition that you're putting forth, but it's not exactly the same. So I'm wondering if there is a case that is that precise, that says an insurance company waives any defense if it doesn't make that clear in its initial response.
Yes, Your Honor. The case is Johnson versus Bankers Mutual Casualty Company, 151 Northwest at 415. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in that case cites a host of its previous cases with the same rationale. So when you have a claim of failure of notice, what the Supreme Court has said is if you're denying it not on notice, but on, you know, the terms of the contract, then you've waived it. So that is the citation. Second, it is Western National that bears the burden of proving actual prejudice from an insured's failure to provide timely notice of a claim or suit. Western National argues it is prejudice because of the default judgment, but a liability insurer fails to prove prejudice where it could have moved to set aside the default judgment but chose not to. Here, Western National learned of the default judgment against its insured within the one-year limitation in setting aside a default judgment. Western National elected not to intervene and try to set aside the default judgment, and the failure to do so deprives Western National of its actual prejudice defense. Here, if Western National had proceeded to seek vacation, Bella Vista would have necessarily not opposed that there was good cause to reopen, because if the district court concluded there was not good cause, that would aid Western National's assertion of prejudice resulting from the default judgment and thereby support avoiding paying the claim. Western National would have had to have shown that Watertight had a meritorious defense. If it had no meritorious defense, then Western National wasn't prejudiced by the late notice, as it would have been unable to change the outcome of the underlying suit even with timely notice. So here, if the judgment was vacated, the action could again proceed. But the failure to even move to vacate deprives Western National of its claim of actual prejudice.
Ms. Hunt, can I follow up? To clarify, and assuming we agree with your client in the underlying issue, so the matter and deny, I know there was a competing summary judgment motion, as I recall, but if the matter is remanded, in your client's position, the issue of prejudice, would it still be litigated? Generally, it's a fact issue. I'm assuming your client's position is that is something that yet would be considered either in a pretrial or in a fact-finding way.
Well, generally, you're correct, Your Honor. Generally, the showing of actual prejudice is a question of fact. So it would be something that Western National has the obligation to prove. But what I'm saying is on this record, when you look at the record that is before the court, there is no way that Western National can show as a matter of law that it has actual prejudice, which is its position before this court.
Ms. Hunt, there is a provision in the declaration from Ms. Wingate that says, quote, well, Western National was aware of the Bella Vista lawsuit by virtue of the notice and tenders. It was unaware Watertight was an insured or might be claiming an entitlement to coverage because Watertight did not comply with policy requirements regarding notice. So it seems that statement alone is something that you're asking us to find the record outweighs that statement, because that statement would suggest that there's a question of fact as to whether Western National was aware of the of that Watertight wasn't insured or might be claiming coverage.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm talking about is the initial denial letter. I mean, when the denial letter was sent by Western National, it obviously knew Watertight wasn't insured. That's what it was addressing. And in that denial letter, it did not assert any claim of actual prejudice or any late notice. It went right to, well, we don't know if there's an occurrence of property damage. And then it talks about the bankruptcy, which really, I mean, is contrary to their policy. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is at the time that they denied coverage, they didn't assert any kind of claim of, you know, a notice problem. And in fact, in Ms. Wingate's declaration, she acknowledges that her April letter was an outright denial. So in Western National's denial letter, I mean, she didn't assert late notice. And actually, then she later declared in her first declaration that Western National had not received notice from Watertight or any party concerning the litigation or any claims involving the project. And that's not true. So then in her subsequent declaration, she walks that back. So in fact, Western National had available to it all the experts' reports. I mean, it could have come in. I mean, it knew what went on in the underlying litigation. Turning to the issue of what Bella Vista established, Bella Vista established there was property damage that occurred during Western National's policy period. And on that ground, it is appellants and not Western National that is entitled to summary judgment. There's undisputed expert testimony presented showing tracing the water intrusion and resulting damage to Western National's policy, period.
But Ms. Hunt, in Minnesota, if you get a default judgment against an insured, which is what happened here, that doesn't automatically establish coverage. It seems like there would be disputed facts.
You're right, Your Honor, that a default judgment doesn't establish coverage. But in the summary judgment motions brought in this declaratory judgment action seeking coverage, the plaintiff, Bella Vista, presented expert testimony establishing that there was an occurrence of property damage within the policy period by expert testimony. That wasn't refuted by Western National. So on this record, there is the establishment and occurrence of property damage. The same thing happened in the Kings Cove case. I mean, that was decided, the occurrence piece, on summary judgment. Then it turns to the exclusion of whether there was the your work exclusion applies, which is Western National's position. Well, then what happens if the court concludes the your work exclusion applies? The issue of allocating what is to your work and excluded and what is part of the coverage goes to the trial court, and that's what Kings Cove holds. So what we're asking this court to do is reverse the grant of summary judgment in favor of Western National. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And good morning, Mr. Bjorkman. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Bjorkman, and I represent the respondent, Western National Mutual Insurance Company. We'd respectfully submit that the district court correctly granted Western National summary judgment and should be affirmed for at least three reasons. First, the Miller-Shugart was invalid because it failed to allocate the damages. Second, if this is being viewed as a default judgment scenario, the default voided any coverage that existed because Western National had no notice and opportunity to defend. And third, Bella Vista, regardless of whether this court views this as a Miller-Shugart scenario, a default judgment scenario, or something else, Bella Vista failed to prove property damage during the time the Western National policy was in force. So let me start with the Miller-Shugart and appellant's suggestion that, well, Kings Cove really answers the question with respect to the district court's ruling. It does not. Kings Cove addressed the issue of allocation with single defendants between covered and uncovered damages. Kings Cove left fully intact Minnesota law with respect to the allocation, the need for allocation in a Miller-Shugart where there are multiple defendants. The Hankslaven case remains in full force and effect. And here, the district court concluded the Miller-Shugart settlement was unreasonable and failed as a matter of law, both because it failed to allocate between multiple defendants, and second, it failed to allocate between covered and uncovered. So the
district. I'm sorry. If you want to finish your thought, my intention was to ask to the reverse hypothetical. I guess I did ask Ms. Hunt, and if you're ready, I'll ask you now. If you want to finish your thought, that's fine.
Feel free, Your Honor.
I guess my question, just to clarify, would. What would be different, assuming those assignments with the Miller-Shugart on it did not exist? Would you agree, number one, that their direct action against your client was proper here and a dismissal would have been improper?
Well, no, I wouldn't. I mean, and it goes to one of the court's earlier questions. What was the purpose for these assignments? And counsel suggests, well, it was really to obtain the cooperation of a party who didn't participate in the underlying litigation and relieve them of liability. Well, I'm not so sure we agree with that. I mean, if you look at the assignments, they were the result of the realization the default judgment they obtained was void against Western National because of a lack of notice. And you'll see the assignments, the Miller-Shugart agreements, attempt to address that. The paragraph 9 of the original assignment speaks to, well, once we told Western National about the default judgment and gave them an opportunity to do something, they denied coverage. So they're attempting to remedy the lack of notice for the default. And the Miller-Shugart assignment also attempts to address the allocation issue, at least between covered and uncovered, and fails at that. So I think the district court was correct to begin with to view this as a Miller-Shugart scenario, and under Kings Cove and Hanks-Laban, it fails as a matter of law. And the appellant's position is, you know, well, it was really a default judgment. It's not a true Miller-Shugart. Well, if you go back and look at the Interlochen case, of course, that was a scenario where there was a jury verdict, and which then resulted in a subsequent assignment. And so they proceeded here, not as a judgment creditor, which they were fully entitled to do and pursue enforcement of the garnish of the under the garnishment statutes of the default. They proceeded as an assignee attempting to establish coverage. So on the first point, I think the court can and should affirm the district court. The district court was correct. The Miller-Shugart's invalid. But that moves us to, even if you wanted to view this as a default judgment scenario, the notice issue is a significant issue. And Bella Vista claims that, well, Western National had notice of the underlying action by virtue of participating in the defense of two other policyholders. But as Judge Bryan noted in the affidavit, Western National did not have notice that Bella Vista or Watertight was seeking coverage as an insured under the policy. And under Minnesota law, Home and Ortega, Holmes, a Minnesota Supreme Court case, that isn't notice sufficient to trigger Western National's obligations to do anything. So there we had a default judgment entered against Western National without notice, which then brings up the prejudice issue. Helen suggests, well, there was no prejudice. Well, because Western National could have attempted to vacate the default. Again, we've cited the Hooper case. Hooper, it's not, number one, Western National didn't have an obligation to vacate the default judgment in the first instance. Second, even if the default judgment had been vacated, it ignores the time that it had elapsed, what had occurred in the underlying action, and raises significant prejudice issues there. Again, Hooper talks directly to that point. One of the more significant issues, in addition to the fact the underlying case had been essentially fully litigated, most of the parties had settled out, is that Bella Vista avoided a 2-year statute of limitations problem in the underlying action by establishing that they didn't discover the damages to the property until 2015. And as part of that ruling, the court found that the first experience of property damage wasn't until 2012. Well, of course, now you heard appellant's counsel argue, well, the damage, there's actually proof in the record that the damage started in 2006.
Mr. Bjorkman, isn't there a distinction to be made between when you discover the damage and when the damage occurs? And when you're talking about what's important here is a triggering occurrence, you're looking to when the damage occurred, not when they discovered it, so you can look to that expert report. Isn't there a distinction to be made? It seems like you're conflating those two, the occurrence and the discovery of the occurrence.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. There is a big difference. The 2-year statute deals with discovery of the damage. The triggering event, of course, is the existence of the damage, which the damage can exist and not be discovered for purpose of triggering the policy. But the problem here is, And our point is that by not giving us notice until long after all this occurred, Western National was unable to get involved in, number one, defending and investigating the underlying action, but more importantly, as indicated in Hooper, we were unable to get involved and press a coverage issue which would have necessitated the appellant, the evidence the appellant is pointing to now is a report that didn't exist until long after the underlying action was concluded, long after the default judgment was entered. And to get more directly to your point, Judge Bryan, there is a difference between discovery and existence. But what they argued to the district court in the underlying action in order to get past the discovery issue was there was nothing that existed. We could not have possibly discovered it because there was nothing that existed, which led to the district court's remark in the summary judgment ruling. Well, the first experience of it was it didn't exist until 2012, and it didn't exist in such a way that it could be discovered until 2015. And so our point on that issue is that alone is a showing of prejudice. Not vacating the default judgment is one thing, but trying to unring the bell in terms of all the underlying settlements, all the investigation that had taken place, and the ruling with respect to the discovery of the damage, which so the default, there was no notice, it voided coverage, which only serves to highlight the final point on the regardless of whether we view this as a Miller-Shugart, regardless of whether you view this as a default judgment, as appellant's counsel concedes, there has to be coverage. There isn't coverage. You don't need to worry about allocating anything. If there isn't coverage, it doesn't. The existence of a default judgment doesn't establish anything as to Western National. So the point then becomes, what's the record evidence of the existence of property damage during the policy period? And Appellant's briefing relies heavily on the Parr case. Well, if you look at the Parr case, what Parr talks about is you got to look at the evidence that existed at the time of the default judgment. And the lone piece of evidence they want to point to as the so-called proof, unrebutted proof of property damage is an expert report that didn't exist until years after all of this occurred. And it was a report written by the same expert who submitted four prior reports to the district court in order to avoid the statute of limitations defense. So,
Mr. Bjorkman, can I just clarify in that latter point? I'm assuming that would be more relevant if there had been a motion to vacate a default judgment. But here, isn't it true that if the matter's remanded, the issue of coverage and the occurrence date, et cetera, would all still be litigated? So in that sense, your client has not lost that opportunity to make those arguments factually and legally.
Well, yes and no, Your Honor. We take the same converse position that the appellant does. There's nothing to remand here. There was a summary judgment motion. They had the burden to prove it was covered in the first instance, and they submitted an affidavit that doesn't establish anything and is in fact inconsistent, or submitted an expert report that is inconsistent with the evidence that underlies the default judgment to begin with. We've cited the Progressive case. We've cited the Kistner case. Court, you can't flip-flop. You can't take one position in the underlying action in order to avoid a statute of limitations damage. We couldn't have discovered anything because it didn't exist. We couldn't experience it. It wasn't experienced until 2012 at the earliest, and then come in after the fact with another report that contradicts what the prior reports were to say, well, in fact, Your Honors, the damage started in 2006 and was ongoing from 2006 all the way up to 2015. That's not sufficient evidence. We've cited the case law. It doesn't establish anything. So there's really nothing to remand. The district court was correct on the point it addressed. The Miller-Shugart is invalid. It failed to allocate between the multiple defendants. Affirmed. If it's not a Miller-Shugart, the district court didn't address the default issue. The default judgment, Western National had no notice of that and was prejudiced by that, and that voided coverage. There was nothing to assign. There's nothing to allocate. The district court could properly have granted summary judgment on that point, and that this court can affirm on that point. And regardless of what the how the court views, whether this is a Miller-Shugart or a default judgment, the third issue addresses there has to be coverage under the policy in the first instance. And to be have coverage under the Western National policy, there has to be property damage that occurred prior to expiration of the policy in April of 2006. There's nothing in the record. The building wasn't even finished until that time. The default judgment was premised on evidence they submitted that the damage didn't exist until long after, such that they couldn't even discover it until 2015. So there are multiple reasons why this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borkin. Ms. Hunt.
With regard to the King's Cove decision, first, it is the appellant's position that this is not a Miller-Shugart, so this court's decision in King's Cove never governed. But what the trial court ruled was that it says, simply put, Bella Vista's Miller-Shugart agreement, authentic or otherwise, is invalid and it fails to meet the requirements for enforceability set forth in King's Cove. So the trial court was looking expressly at King's Cove, this court's decision requiring an allocation between covered and uncovered damages. So with the reversal of King's Cove by the Minnesota Supreme Court, that necessarily leads to reversal of the district court's decision. The Western National's reading of what is left of the Corn Plus doctrine of allocation after King's Cove, Minnesota Supreme Court decision is incorrect. I mean, what the Minnesota Supreme Court just said is, look, if you have an issue with regard to either a judgment or you have a Miller-Shugart judgment, the allocation issue goes back to the district court. It's not a reason to preclude or grant summary judgment dismissal. Turning to the occurrence-based policy issue, Minnesota law is clear. An occurrence-based policy is triggered even when damage is not diagnosable, compensable, or manifest during the policy period, as long as it can be determined retroactively that some damage did occur in the policy period. Appellant has made that showing by expert testimony, which has not been refuted. What Western National points to is the trial court's order denying Gorey's motion against Bella Vista on statute of limitations grounds, where the trial court held there is a disputed issue of fact as to the date of discovery of the construction defects for statute of limitation purposes. In that order denying summary judgment, the trial court states, quote, although there were moisture infiltration issues and stucco issues that Bella Vista first experienced in 2012, Western National tries to turn that statement into a judicial ruling there was no damage in fact before 2012. But if you look at document 30, which is the Bella Vista's response, it lays out what the record is. What the trial court was referring to is the fact that Mr. Aldean of Everlasting Homes, a stucco maintenance expert, reported in 2012 that he saw front entry ceiling leak in some west side stucco cracks. It's a no big deal. But in 2015, TNT's Stocco reviewed the situation and told Bella Vista, well, you've got a host of issues going on here. There's water behind the stucco. So Bella Vista internally discussed the issue and the fact that Everlasting Homes didn't see any issue and they didn't know who to believe. So it was in 2015 that Bella Vista retained an engineer and did an independent evaluation leading to the discovery of the injury in 2015, as the trial court states, and the commencement of this action in 2016. But none of this has anything to do with whether Bella Vista has established some damage did occur in Western National's policy period. The trial court's reference to first experience in 2012 in an order denying summary judgment was not a ruling that there were no damages, in fact, occurring prior to that time, but was referring to what was seen in 2012, as the record suggests. So what we have here is we've got a situation where Bella Vista has established on this record that there was an occurrence of property damage within Western National's policy period, which then leads to Western National's obligation to show that there's an exclusion that applies. And I didn't even hear them argue this morning the your work exclusion. But assuming that the court would assume that Western National somehow met its burden of proof that the your work exclusion, then the allocation is done by the trial court. It's not a ground to dismiss this action. So appellants respectfully request that this court reverse the summary judgment dismissal of appellant's action. Thank you.
Ms. Hunt, before we let you go, can you repeat that site again? I think you said Johnson 151 Northwest 2nd 415, but I might have misheard you. This is regarding the waiver, the cases that show.
Johnson versus Bankers Mutual Casualty Company, 151 Northwest. And the pinpoint site is 415.
Okay. I appreciate that. Seeing no other questions, we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you both very much for your arguments. And